I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. There's an old cemetery near where I live, where my dog and I often walk. Some of the gravestones are grand, some are modest, some are hard to read because the words have been worn away by weather and time, and some, frankly, break my heart. There's a small headstone with a carved lamb on top and the name of a newborn etched into the stone with the simple and poignant words, "Too soon." Our guest Greg Millville's curiosity about cemeteries began in college when he dug graves and mowed the grass at Shawsheen Cemetery in Bedford, Massachusetts. He traveled the country with his family visiting burial grounds for his new book, Over My Dead Body, Unearthing the Hidden History of America's Cemeteries. He joins us on Radio Times to talk about how burial practices have evolved, how segregated graveyards and the mistreatment of native burial grounds reflect our troubled past, how cemeteries became parks, places for picnicking, and inspired writers and poets. Today, there's a growing interest in natural burial grounds like the one in Laurel Hill just outside of Philadelphia. Greg Millville drove up from Middletown, Delaware to join us here in Philadelphia. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you with us. So let me just make sure our listeners can join us. We're going to talk about a lot of stuff related to graveyards and gravestones and also death and dying. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. My brother dug graveyards or burial plots. You say Abraham Lincoln did that, Tom Petty as well.
Yes.
So what is it like to work at a graveyard?
It was a lot different than I imagined at first. Graveyards can kind of get a bum rap because of all the dead people, and I get that. But what I wasn't prepared for was just the amazing stories, kind of like the one that you just related. And there's so many incredible stories that these cemeteries tell, and every cemetery has its own story. And so during the summer that I worked there, it really unfolded to me the past of my town and the families and the economics and the culture and the art. And it all just came alive to me, for lack of a better word.
Well, yeah, and I was thinking of another, and this cemetery where I walk, a lot of people walk there with their dogs. There's another gravestone, and it's created like a double bed, so that mm-hmm. the headstone is the husband and the wife, and it's shaped like a double bed. And I thought, boy, that tells me so much about this couple that I've, of course, never met.
Yeah.
And died a long time ago.
Right, right. It certainly does. I think about the cemeteries where, or the headstones where perhaps one person passes away and then there's a name engraved for another person who has their birth date, but then not their death date. And I wonder, what happened there? Mm-hmm. What is that story?
Well, I find that maybe the older I get, I do the math when I'm walking by to say, well, how long did they live,
right,
actually? And why did they die, of
mm-hmm.
course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's so much more to it, just the art of the gravestones or the markers themselves, the spacing within the cemetery, how the cemetery is designed, how it blends with nature, and how it's used in different ways. Are there a lot of runners who run through there and cyclists? Is it part of the community, or is it forgotten?
You traveled the country, and I'm curious about how you convinced your family, especially your children, to go with you to visit all these cemeteries.
Well, I recount a bunch of different times that we went to different cemeteries, and it was usually as part of our travels, but not the primary reason for. The times that it was the primary reason for usually involved a lot of bribery, mostly.
Right. And that works, doesn't it?
Quite well, yes.
But what I appreciated is you say when we think of cemeteries, they were the first really public art museums.
Yes.
The first parks. I mean, in so many ways, especially when we look around our own country, you can see that.
Right. And Central Park was basically created because of the popularity of Greenwood Cemetery in Brooklyn, which at that time was the second most popular tourist attraction in America, yeah, besides Niagara Falls. And basically city planners thought, well, wouldn't it be nice to have this central park that doesn't have dead bodies in it? And so that was essentially how Central Park was created in Manhattan.
Well, let's go back to the beginning and even go back to other species, as you write, that bury their dead. Who are we talking about, or what are we talking about?
Well, I guess humans aren't necessarily unique in that regard. We think of it as being kind of this spiritual journey that only we go on. But if you really want to get down to it, even ants will bury their dead.
Which is, ants are extraordinary little creatures, we are learning. I'm thinking of elephants as well, when an member of the tribe, in a sense, dies.
Yes. And I think that we don't know what dolphins do if there are graveyards in the deep. I'm assuming there aren't. But this connection we have with death transcends not just humanity, for sure.
You talk about, I guess, the earliest graveyard is in what's now Israel. Is that at least far as we know?
Right.
What is there?
Basically, it dates back 100,000 years, and that's the first kind of intentional spot where people were memorialized. And there was alcohol there, which continues to this day as part of traditions.
Sure.
And then there were markers and there were flowers that were left that were placed specifically with the bodies of people. So it was very clear that this was a very symbolic place.
You also say in North America, the first, or I guess the oldest body discovered, at least so far, goes back something like 12,000, 13,000 years.
Right.
Who did we find?
We found the body of, we believe, a young boy who, it's kind of really fascinating that the DNA from this set of remains is one that is shared with indigenous people, not only in North America, but South America as well, to a large degree. And it was, again, a body that wasn't just found deposited in the ground, but was intentionally placed with tools and weapons and other objects that clearly were intended for the afterlife.
And this was in what is now Montana. Who discovered this body? How was it discovered?
It was on a farm, and it had basically been dug up and discovered, these remains, and then archaeologists were notified about it, yeah.
Is there anything uniquely American about the way we bury our dead or treat our dead?
There are many things, actually. From embalming, the method of embalming is something that is not uniquely American, but is shared by very few countries, mostly English-speaking countries, and really pioneered in the United States. Most other cultures and countries around the world do not embalm, and it's kind of a Christian thing as well. So in Judaism, you don't embalm the dead. In Islam, you don't embalm the dead either. That's a big thing. And this notion that everyone gets a trophy, everyone gets a resting place with a gravestone of their own, is also kind of an American thing as well.
To say, I was here.
Exactly.
I'm also curious about why we bury the dead.
Well, there are
we meaning human beings, but why?
It goes a little beyond my expertise somewhat, but basically when you get down to it, there is the practical reason of burying the dead so that you are protecting the body from humans and then animals as well. And then, of course, in culturally going way back, there were also these explanations that in Greek culture where the underworld is where people pass to, their bodies are closer to the crossing in that way by burying them underground.
You write about body snatchers, and I guess that's another reason to try to protect the dead. But a group that was affiliated with Harvard University, the Spunker Club, what did they do?
So basically, when there was this proliferation of medical schools that arose at the beginning of the 19th century, there were not enough cadavers for the students at these various medical schools in Europe and in the United States. And so medical students, in order to help in their research, were known to dig up graves in urban cemeteries and take them back in order to perform dissections on them. And it got to the point where it was so bad that it had to be in Boston. They turned it into a felony to grave rob.
Because there was this bunker club, I guess, was doing so much damage.
Yes, and not too long ago, the bones of a lot of these illegally collected cadavers were found in a wall that a custodian had opened up. And interesting stories.
Indeed. Yeah. Well, these were called body snatchers, as you say, were known as resurrection men.
Yes.
Which is an interesting turn of phrase.
Of course, of course. I guess bringing to life, bringing to use these bodies once again.
Here's an email from Elizabeth. She says, when I lived in Maui 40 years ago, I used to walk with my son on my back for hours. We often visited a tiny graveyard, probably not more than 15 graves, and there was a grave of a baby who lived for 5 days in the 1940s. It had fresh flowers on it every time I was there. And again, these really poignant stories that are associated with cemeteries and gravestones.
Right.
And the people who were buried there.
Yeah, it really is amazing. I think about when I lived in Massachusetts on Cape Cod, and in the Nickerson State Park, there were several small graveyards within the state park. And you see that in state parks and national parks all over the place, where the Smoky Mountain National Park, for instance, there are several old graveyards that are placed in there, including one that holds Dolly Parton's grandfather.
Oh my gosh.
And it's so poignant to stumble across these places. It wouldn't surprise me if there's no relative to this person where the flowers are going in Hawaii, but it's just someone who feels moved by these graves and passes it all the time.
Which reminds me of another story related to this graveyard that I go. There was a man who was there every time I was there, sort of talking to this gravestone. And when I looked at it, I saw it was a soldier who had died, I think, in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And he was there every day, sort of pacing and talking to this gravestone. I assumed it was his son.
Yeah.
And again, sort of broke my heart. But also, here he was able to commune with someone that he clearly and dearly loved.
Right. And that's the thing about cemeteries, as opposed to other methods, perhaps, or even this idea that everyone gets a grave plot, is that it does provide that connection for the families, in a lot of cases, to be able to commune with their loved ones.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Greg Millville is our guest today on Radio Times. He's got a brand new book. It's titled Over My Dead Body, subtitled Unearthing the Hidden History of America's Cemeteries. And he did travel around the country visiting cemeteries, unearthing, to use a phrase, unearthing some of the histories of these cemeteries and what they say about the people who are buried there, the people who love them, and also the country in which they lived. You can join our conversation. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Aim. We are talking about how cemeteries both reveal and reflect our nation's changing beliefs, taboos, rituals, reveal a lot about our troubled past. And again, our guest is Greg Millville, author of a brand new book, Over My Dead Body. Well, let's talk about the burial of the segregated cemeteries that you came across. But I wanted just to make one note. You write that 6 million people of African descent died before the end of the Civil War. So the question is, where are those bodies? And I'm assuming no one, you know, for the most part, we do not know where they are.
For the most part, we don't. The history of Black cemeteries in America is largely one of desecration, erasure, and willful neglect. And we understand that cemeteries are this important kind of document of history. And there is this willful act of erasure that is part of trying to to erase the historical record that I think is very poignant and important to understand with a lot of these burial grounds that are lost.
Well, and reflecting our history, right? Well, I mean,
exactly.
What we did to people in death, we did to them in life.
Yes, absolutely.
No, go ahead.
No, just it's in death. Death really does show what, or I should say, how we treat the dead really does reflect how a culture acts, right? And so we see that with unfiltered clarity with graveyards.
Well, let's talk about Laurel Grove Cemetery. This is in Savannah, Georgia.
Yes.
You went there to visit. Describe the cemetery for us then.
Sure. So there are two sections, and basically it was created in 1853. So there was a black section and a white section, and the which was very typical of cemeteries of that time in the South. But also, when you look at segregation, also affected cemeteries even around here. For instance, Eden Cemetery locally was created at the turn of the 20th century as a result of segregation because the black community in Philadelphia did not have a place for, did not have many integrated burial grounds. So in Laurel Grove, really, it's really striking to look at the two cemeteries today. In the 1980s, a interstate was built which carved the cemetery physically in half, which has so much symbolism attached to it, especially
Indeed.
With the construction of interstates in urban areas during that time. And the White Cemetery is this kind of well-kept, immaculate, gorgeous cemetery with all of these elaborate tombstones and mausoleums. And then even though both sides of the cemetery are owned by the city of Savannah, the other side of the cemetery, the historically black section, doesn't nearly receive the same resources for upkeep. Mm-hmm. The graves are much different. And even just finding it on a map app is much more difficult to get to the entrance. Or, for instance, I mentioned that even finding pictures of it on map apps, it shows pictures. You can find pictures of the white section, but not of the historically African Americans.
And that's true today.
Yeah, it is.
Wow. Wow. Let me read a couple of more comments. These are all over the place, which I appreciate. Luann says, I've been intrigued about accounts of composting bodies down to soil. I hope we do more of that. And that is a trend now, right?
Absolutely. So there are 5 states that now allow composting, human composting, which is basically you speed up the decomposition process by putting people in a metal tank and adding organic materials to it and pressurizing. And it is definitely becoming the most recent state to legalize it is California. And when California does something, it usually does it in a big way. And,
yes. A lot of people out there.
Yeah, there are a lot of people out there. So that kind of, I have a feeling that that's really going to light a spark under this process, this natural process.
Let me read a couple of more comments. One from Susie. My grandmother was a Mennonite and Pennsylvania Dutch, and as a child, my dad and his whole extended family would pack a lunch for a picnic in the cemetery and tell stories about each relative. It was a tradition he never warmed up to, but in that culture, an important way to honor ancestors, nothing spooky or creepy about it to them.
Yeah, that's
not
great.
Unusual, right?
No, and you think about Laurel Hill itself, and Laurel Hill, when it was first created,
was Philadelphia area.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. Was one of the first urban parks in the country, and people would specifically go there not just to commune with the dead or just see family members, but that was part of it, mm-hmm. but to actually go and picnic and recreate and enjoy the outdoors, which at that time was considered something to be conquered more than to preserved.
And I guess the idea in Philadelphia was that they were literally running out of room for where to bury the bodies. And so Laurel Hill, which I guess was countryside then, was a very good real estate.
Exactly. And that was really the first cemetery that was untethered from houses of worship in the Philadelphia area. At that time, Christ Church Burial Ground was overflowing with bodies. And so this notion of having a cemetery or burial ground on the outskirts of town that's not attached necessarily to a house of worship was this totally radical idea, even though to us it's so commonplace today.
Let me add one more thing that you also write about. This is the desecration, really, of native burial grounds. And again, you know, reflecting our history. Help us understand that.
Yeah, so really, and that begins really with the pilgrims coming across. And they first stopped on Cape Cod before they went to Plymouth. And they were looking for treasure and a place perhaps to settle, and they found these spots where things were buried. And so they dug them up, and there were some bodies, but then also corn and stores of grain for the afterlife. And the pilgrims started looking for graves so that they could have some food. Wow. And it actually this act of grave robbing in order to steal the supplies kept them sustained through the winter, but it also began this unending tradition, basically, of desecration and destruction of indigenous people's graves that really has continued to this day.
In 1990, though, there was the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act.
Yes.
I mean, how effective has that been?
Somewhat. So you even take Usamequin or Massasoit, who was the person who brought the first Thanksgiving to the pilgrims, and he was buried in Rhode Island. And in the 1900s, his grave was dug up to make way for a railroad, which is ironic, of course. And his bones basically went into collections, which was so common to the point where the Smithsonian had the bones of indigenous people and other private collections and museums as well. And so this act enabled people to be able to repatriate their ancestors and family members' bones and put them back in their resting places, including Massasoit. But it's only somewhat effective, right? And not everywhere can be protected, especially from grave robbers and pot hunters, as they're called. Bears Ears National Monument out in Utah, one of the main reasons why this area is protected is because they are sacred, not just sacred grounds in general, but sacred burial grounds as well.
Well, and as if memory works for me, President Obama tried to protect it. President Trump undid that. What's the status now? Do we know?
So a lot of it has been brought back under the Biden administration to the original boundaries under President Obama. But there are still legal fights going on in order to make it happen. So it's not out of the woods yet. But a lot of that land is back.
You say about Jewish cemeteries that they were, on one hand, an expression of religious liberty, but also targets for anti-Semites, which, of course, makes sense when you think about it.
Right. You look at Mikveh Israel Cemetery in Philadelphia, which is one of the oldest standing Jewish cemeteries in America. And it has a fence and a wall around it. And it's not a mistake that you go and look at a lot of the other historic cemeteries that don't need to be protected in the same way that historic, very important Jewish cemeteries do in the United States.
And still has to be protected today?
Absolutely. Yeah. Because of the acts of anti-Semitism, the symbolic acts of destroying or defacing a cemetery.
Let me read a couple of more comments. One from Leslie. She says, when I was a child, we used to go to a cemetery to learn about lots of different people, look at the stones as art, to picnic. It was simply an interesting thing to do and really useful for us to see this type of art as children. And you talk about these are really our first public art presentations.
They certainly were. In the early to mid-19th century, art was generally kept in private collections. There were no public art museums. Those really arose in the late 19th century. So before that, these cemeteries arose, and they were great places for artists to get commissions and architects. But then also they were the only places where people, the public, could go for free and really enjoy art. And this was this huge revelation, especially in Philadelphia and then in New York as well, in Brooklyn at Greenwood Cemetery.
And as we know, cemeteries have inspired poets and writers forever.
Of course. So Walt Whitman was very partial to Greenwood Cemetery in Brooklyn. Emily Dickinson, Mount Auburn in Boston. And also you have Ralph Waldo Emerson, who helped create a cemetery in Concord, Massachusetts, in order to protect land. He saw it as really kind of meshing with the transcendental philosophy that he was such a big proponent of returning back to the earth. And so with help from Henry David Thoreau and others in Concord, Massachusetts, they created this cemetery on the edge of town as the country's first conservation project.
Wow. Do you have a favorite cemetery? I mean, one that you feel a special fondness and connection to?
There are a couple. I really love Hollywood Forever Cemetery out in California because it's kitschy and it's eclectic and you have peacocks running around and all of these really gaudy statues, but then some beautiful statues as well. And it's a place where they've kind of embraced the community, or the community has embraced them. So they have movies and concerts, and it's become a place where you want to take your date.
Cool. Well, let me just quickly reintroduce you. And again, we are talking about our nation's cemeteries. And our guest is Greg Millville. And he's written a new book. It's called Over My Dead Body. And it's subtitled Unearthing the Hidden History of America's Cemeteries. We've been talking about some of that history today on Radio Times. And as always on Radio Times, you can join our conversation. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call that phone number 1-888-477-9499. PJ asks, how does moving around or societal mobility affect burial practices? I left Pittsburgh in the 70s after graduating college. I rarely have the opportunity to visit my father's grave there. I'd rather my kids cremate me and scatter my ashes rather than burying me in a place they will move 1,000 miles away from. I mean, it is interesting to think about mobility and you know, where people are left in their grave.
Yeah, and cemeteries are always evolving. We think of them as being these kind of static fixtures. But really, the way we're buried today or memorialized today is very different from 100 years ago. It's very different from 200 or 300 years ago. And mobility does affect that. It does affect whether or not we decide to be buried. For instance, now more Americans are cremated than they are buried. And I'm sure that mobility has a large part to do with that.
And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Got a bunch of emails, a lot of interest in this topic. I'm not surprised by that. Here's an email from Eddie. I found two of my great uncles in an unmarked grave in Fernwood Cemetery. They were buried by the famous Philly undertaker, Oliver Bear, who would buy plots and provide a burial for poor families for $1.75, but without a marker. I bought the plot and commissioned a stone for Harry and George. Buried with them are five adult strangers from 1913. I put their names on the back of the stone. That's a great story.
That's amazing. Yeah, it really is.
But the idea I guess, an undertaker essentially buying up plots and sort of making sure that people have a place to go when they die.
It is. And obviously, in the business of death, there are some amazing people who really do usher families through this incredibly traumatic process. And they really do good work. But there's also that side of profit. There's immense profit in the death industry. So there's always this balance on charity versus profit, intentions of various people, giving away graves but not giving away grave markers.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
Allowing people to be buried in an unmarked grave. Well, you know, there's the balance right there.
Indeed. Let's talk a little bit about Gettysburg. You have a chapter on that, which, of course, is where the battlefield was. I'm not sure how many people died in that particular battle, but in the Civil War, I think it was something like 600,000 people died during that war. And you say that really changed a lot of our thinking about, I guess, the dead, dying.
Yes.
And also cemeteries.
Right. So up until that time, the so-called good death was where someone would die at home around family. Someone would collect their last words, and then family members and loved ones would carry them in a pine box probably to the local churchyard where they would be buried. But the dying on the battlefield, dying at Gettysburg, was not a good death at all. And people were wondering, well, will my loved one reach salvation? And Lincoln, among others, really had to grapple with that. Well, how do I define the good death? And so the Gettysburg Address was really about redefining what the good death is in America, how people who can die on the battlefield, oftentimes without any identification, how can they consecrate land.
That's right. He used that word, right?
And so the Gettysburg Address, among other things, was also about redefining what the good death is for Americans. And it did. It radically changed how we looked at the good death.
And it's an extraordinary – everyone should visit Gettysburg for a whole host of reasons, but an extraordinary place to go and see the markers, the, you know, the way the dead and that battle are commemorated.
Yeah, it really is chilling. It's a transformative place. Like, you go back in time when you go there, and you can't help but imagine yourself in the scene when you go to a place like Gettysburg.
Yeah, and you see, I was mentioning this before going on the air, what I observed were the sort of more modest statuary from the north and the more flamboyant statuary from the south. And I don't know if I'm, you know, making something up or not, but it seems so apparent to me.
Yeah, and you're right. And what's interesting about that is that those types of monuments were all generally created, a lot of them even in the 20th century, right? So the late 19th century and the early 20th century, and generally the monuments were put up during times of civil unrest, usually as a symbolic way of I don't know if repression is the right word, but an answer to civil uprisings and consciousness on repression.
Well, we're almost having a break here, but, you know, looking at it, it almost feels as if the South thought that maybe they won the war, just looking at the statuary, right?
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about cemeteries today on Radio Times, really a history of cemeteries. And again, our guest is Greg Melville. He's got a new book we've been talking about. It's called Over My Dead Body, Unearthing the Hidden History of America's Cemeteries. We're going to take a very short break. We've got a lot of comments here, questions that people have, stories that they want to tell, which is terrific because in many ways, how we bury people, how we remember them is such a poignant thing in all of our lives. So let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, and if you are just joining us, we are talking about cemeteries today on Radio Times, how they reveal our past, and in some cases, our troubled past, also how they reveal and reflect our changing beliefs and taboos and rituals. Our guest is Greg Melville, and he's written a book called Over My Dead Body. He first got interested in burial grounds when he worked as a grave digger and a graveyard groundskeeper. And again, you can join our conversation. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call that phone number 1-888-477-9499. Let me get back to some of our listeners here because we have a lot of really interesting questions and stories. Here's an email from Elizabeth. She says, as far as I can tell, South Jersey is the closest place to here that allows you to just be planted. Do you know anything closer? Laurel Hill has more requirements. Are you familiar with mushroom suits? Well, let's talk about this. This sort of the natural burial. And Laurel Hill has a spot that you visited. What is natural burials?
Natural burial is really kind of going back in time in a lot of respects to lower impact, lower carbon footprint, more traditional types of burial where oftentimes the graves are hand dug as opposed to by a tractor, where people are either put in a simple pine box of untreated wood or in a shroud and returned to the earth in a more natural way without embalming fluids or that sort of thing. And one of the pioneers really is Nature Sanctuary at Laurel Hill West, which some consider to be the most earth-friendly burial ground in the United States right now. So there are certain requirements there in order to make it as natural as possible.
What is it like when you're there? I mean, what is it like to wander?
So it's not huge. It's about 3 acres. It started as 1 acre, and it's grown to 3 acres. And the walk, it just looks like a bunch of natural flower gardens, mostly. Mm-hmm. There are a few bee apiaries there. And I haven't seen the goats, but they have goats that graze in order to mow, basically, making people like me obsolete from my old job. And really what they're going to allow it to do is turn into forest. And the walkways that go alongside it, there are no grave markers, are all from crushed recycled concrete. Mm-hmm. And there's a memorial wall, not really a wall, but a memorial marker, a long memorial marker with the names of people who were buried inside these grounds because of the no markers in there. It really is beautiful.
Let me quote something you said about visiting there and your reaction to it. You said, "Still reflexively, the new natural cemeteries violate my ingrained ideal of American individualism, how in death everyone gets a trophy, a little plot of earth they call their own, and a gravestone announcing I was here." So clearly, you don't want to be buried there.
I don't.
And you don't have to be.
Okay. I like to think of myself as being really environmentally conscious, and I'm well aware of the environmental impact of traditional cemeteries. But at the same time, I don't need that spot. I don't want to take up that space.
Right. So we're talking cremation for you?
Probably, yeah. We've talked about already today the human composting. I don't know if I can go there.
Sure, go there.
But maybe it's just in my own brain I have to kind of get over the societal hang-ups on something like that. But then there's also aquamation, where you're basically broken down in a vat of water and lye and disposed of. Very, in a way that's lower impact than even cremation, because cremation takes up about the carbon footprint of driving 1,000 miles in a car.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow. I've also heard about creating, I guess, coral or sort of faux coral out of human remains.
I mean,
the idea is that we can help replenish the oceans that we're of course despoiling.
Right. Yeah. There are a bunch of different ways that for natural burial or artisanal death, if you will, that are coming up that are innovative and interesting and really returning people to nature in fascinating ways.
Here's Jenny, who says, embalming was very, very common in ancient times in Egypt. My grandfather was at the opening of King Tut's tomb in 1922. You want to talk about embalming and the Egyptians? Or?
Sure. Not that I'm an Egyptian expert, but basically the death industry in ancient Egypt was in some ways very similar to the way it is today. And it was a profit-making industry in a lot of respects. But there was a gap in embalming basically from ancient Egypt to the mid-19th century in Europe and in the United States. And the embalming methods that were created basically at that time were mostly at first for medical schools in order to preserve cadavers, in order to dissect them and research them.
Well, and speaking about embalming and the body and cremation, which we've been talking about, you remind us that the body is mostly water. So
yeah,
that creates a challenge when it comes to cremation.
It does. It takes a lot of heat. Mm-hmm. Put simply, it takes a lot of – if you're looking at the very natural form of cremation – the ancient form of cremation, it took a lot of wood. It takes a lot of heat. And even today, that's why there is this carbon footprint, right, of driving 1,000 miles, is because of the fossil fuels that are generally used.
Oh, in order to really cremate the body.
Yes.
Let me read a couple of more comments. One from Jim: has there been consolidation in cemetery ownership, like in the funeral home business? I wonder if part of the modern preference for cremation is the way burials, embalming, and are so expensive. I feel like the funeral industry takes advantage by overcharging people at a vulnerable time. I mean, it is interesting now that more people are choosing cremation over burial.
Yes, and part of it is absolutely cost, of course. It is maybe 60% of the cost for the total arrangements of a person to be cremated as opposed to being buried. And there is consolidation in cemeteries. There are companies that own cemeteries and funeral homes. There's one company that basically dabbles in both, and 16 cents of every dollar that is spent on death in America goes to this company because they own so many funeral homes and cemeteries.
Uh-huh. What's their name?
I'd have to look that up.
And we'll see if we can get to the bottom of that.
Yeah.
But cemeteries have to, in a sense, reinvent themselves, right, to keep up with people's changing ideas.
Yeah. I think that the future for cemeteries is really analog. We have this digital immortality now with social media. And right now there are 30 million accounts of people who are no longer living on Facebook. And it's believed that in 50 years, there will be more dead people on Facebook than living. So if you think of basically a cemetery as carrying the essence of our lives and the data of our lives, then Facebook is the largest cemetery in the world by far.
Where we can live forever, right?
Right, exactly. Digital immortality in a much more exhaustive way with much more data than just a gravestone can offer for future generations to know we were there, right? So how do cemeteries compete with that? Well, really by, it seems like what they're doing is more embracing the community. I was talking about Hollywood Forever and how they are a part of the community, not just a place where celebrities are buried, but a place where people want to congregate and be a part of. I think about the Woodlands Cemetery here in Philadelphia, and they have like an adopt-a-grave program where you essentially plant flowers at a gravesite and maintain it. And it's a way for people to feel ownership in a cemetery. Congressional Cemetery in Washington, D.C., if you are a member of the cemetery organization there, you can use the cemetery basically as a dog run. And mm-hmm. so all of these people every morning, it's all fenced in. They allow their dogs to run leashless. It's a really popular place for that. There's one cemetery in Los Angeles that has a jogging track around it. And if you in this analog way, you're allowing people to want to be memorialized and spend the rest of their eternity there, so to speak.
And have the rest of us be able to be there as well, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Sort of incorporate it all right. together. I like that. Let me just make sure you can join our conversation. We've got a lot of calls and comments here. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me read some more comments here. One from Ron. He says, in Quaker cemeteries, the Society of Friends prohibited any identifying markers within their graveyards up until the mid-19th century. This is the way so many older Quaker cemeteries seemingly have so much open space, which in reality, they didn't. That's a very interesting comment.
It is. And really, a lot of cemeteries, like I think if you go to Christ Church Burial Ground, there are many, many more people buried there than there are gravestones. Mm-hmm. Or Trinity Church Burial Ground in New York City in Lower Manhattan, there are something like 1,000 graves for hundreds of thousands of people. But also, it was the pilgrims, when they came across, at first they didn't have any markers either. That became something that did arise later on. So there are a lot of burying grounds, a lot of different customs, depending on the region, depending on the religion, depending on a lot of factors that determined whether or not originally in the United States there were grave markers, but generally there weren't a lot.
Yeah, interesting. Steve says there are a whole mess of cemeteries underwater. Elizabeth says, I always wanted cremation until I saw the carbon footprint. Mm-hmm. And to be honest with you, I did not know about the carbon footprint in
yeah.
cemeteries.
And
cremation, rather, yeah.
Right. And it isn't we drive, how long does it take us to drive 1,000 miles?
Right.
So, but it is there, and there's no nutritional value to cremated remains when you add them back into the environment. So you're not helping fertilize trees or anything like that with the spreading of ashes.
Because it there isn't enough there, or it just doesn't have the properties that would be
exactly
a good fertilizer in a way.
Exactly.
An email from Fiona. I love walking through cemeteries no matter where I go in the world, but the one with perhaps the most beautiful view is in Sydney, Australia, on the cliff near the Bondi Beach, founded in 1877, Waverley Cemetery with 50,000 graves, and it has what would now be a multi-million dollar view. I couldn't think of a better place to lay down forever. That sounds lovely.
Yeah, it does.
I was also thinking about how countries like Mexico do have Days of the Dead, you know, these annual celebrations where people dress up like skeletons and walk through town. I mean, we're mm-hmm. close to Halloween, so we have some version of that. But it is interesting to think of some of these other countries and their rituals that are so connected to the dead
right.
and dying.
I think that we're actually kind of, it seems like, so you take the popularity of cemeteries now, or really the number of visitors who are going to cemeteries, and they have greatly increased in the last few years mm-hmm. for a couple of reasons. First, because they are open spaces where people could go and walk when everything else was closed down. But then also, I think that everyone's everyday connection with death has radically shifted in the last few years.
Right. Because of the pandemic.
Yes,
right?
Exactly. And as a result, I think that kind of the fear of death, this wall that we put up between us and death has come down quite a bit. And so people are showing that with their feet by going to cemeteries and visiting these beautiful places.
And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. It's interesting. I hadn't kind of put two and two together, but I think there is more conversation about death because it was all around us. I mean, I think most of us know someone who died because
right.
of the pandemic. And not that that's a good thing, but I think the ability to talk about death and our own death and to imagine what we want has got to be a healthy conversation.
I would think so, for sure. And I think that it's one that, especially, you know, I teach college English, and I think that it's one that younger generations are much more open to having, believe
yeah.
it or not, than older generations, including my own. I'm 50 years old, just for context, or actually 52. I'm sorry. Don't want to get that right. But it's really interesting that, and I'm not sure if that's the effect of the pandemic or just a general more openness to talk about it. But it's definitely noticeable.
Yeah, yeah. You're a military person, and at one point, I guess, when you were in the early stages of your career there, you had to be asked about, well, what if something happens to you? What happened? How do you want to be buried? Or what do you want to happen to your dead body? What was it like for you to think through all that?
I didn't have a choice. I was being deployed overseas to Afghanistan at the time, and obviously, I had to make certain arrangements in the case of my death. But like I say sometimes, I'm a writer, not a fighter. I'm not someone who's necessarily on the front lines or anything. And really this idea, this notion of what would happen to my remains, how would I want my funeral to be, was very striking to me and forced me to kind of come to grips with that, my own mortality. But that was not a bad thing. That was a good thing. What I requested was that my ashes be put on top of Old Rag in Shenandoah National Park. And my wife and I just actually climbed that a week ago yesterday.
Oh, gosh.
So we got some pictures of that. But
And why there? I mean, just because it's so beautiful.
It means something to you. It's a personal place. It's a happy place. And if I were to go back to nature, that's where I'd want to spend my time in nature.
Right. Well, on that poignant note, my thanks to you, Greg Melville, for joining us today in Radio Times.
It was a great conversation. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. And a lot of interest in this topic as well, which is terrific. And again, our guest has been Greg Melville, and he's got a new book, Over My Dead Body, Unearthing the Hidden History of America's Cemeteries. And for more information about Radio Times, you can go to whyy.org and look for Radio Times under programs. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder and Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for all those comments and stories and calls as well. So thanks for being part of the conversation.